Welcome to Making and Breaking Social Policy, a podcast about social issues and policy and what it all means for social and community practice. My name is Ben Lohmeyer and I host this podcast and I teach the social policy topics in the social work programs at Flinders University. My guest today is the Associate Professor Jonathan Wistow from Durham University in the UK. Jonathan's research connects a range of issues, including health inequalities, climate change adaption, post-industrialism, and class through the application of complexity theory to policy and governance systems. In doing so, his research reveals the political economy functions linking to broader debates about governance and public policy. Jonathan recently published a book titled Social Policy, Political Economy and the Social Contract, which is the focus of our conversation today. This podcast is edited and published on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people. I acknowledge the importance of their relationship with this land and pay respect to their elders past, present and emerging. This episode was recorded in Durham in the UK in 2023. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me today for a chat about your work and your recent book about social policy, political economy and the social contract. So I'm going to ask you more about each of those parts in a moment and get you to explain a little bit for us. But to get us started, can you tell us a bit about how you became interested in this area broadly, but also in your profile, it talks about some of the specific areas you're interested in around health inequalities, climate change, and post-industrialism and class. They seem quite separate and big on their own as well. So can you kind of connect all those dots for us?
Yes, thank you very much for having me as well. I think it's both a bit of, somewhat look, somewhat design, doing these different areas. One thing is I was a contract researcher for quite a while, for maybe 7 or 8 years. So I worked on different research projects and they linked to my research interests, but it was also what was available at different times as contracts were ending. So there is, you know, an element of luck that I ended up in these projects, but they were areas of interest. So I guess, I mean, health inequalities would be a key thing and an early thing that I was interested in since I've been in academia. And that was the first project I worked on. But it was also, it was about then these gaps in local areas, place-based health inequalities and gaps in things like life expectancy and how that relates to then particular forms of mortality from say cancers or circulatory diseases, coronary heart disease. But this was then very much about policy response to this within place and then about sort of governance systems too. And how policy works across different stakeholders in places. So I'd got that kind of expertise, I guess, from my PhD too, which was about local government, local governance. So I'd been interested in that and developed that through the Health Inequalities Project. But then that became really useful and relevant to then the next project I worked on, which was around climate change adaptation within health and social care systems. And again, how are local place-based service providers responding to a particular policy problem or challenge? And how then in that project, we were much more focused on impact, designing tools, toolkits, helping them to implement and integrate climate change adaptation into their sort of their work across. And a really nice, potentially nice phrase that one of the principal investigators on the project came up with was about conceptualizing these as multi-scalar systems and cross-sectoral systems, and the need for this form of resilience to be integrated across local areas, across sort of levels, as well as cross sectors as well. So that linked to the governance kind of stuff. And the post-industrialism and class, again, something that I would have been interested in, you know, going back to my undergraduate days. But then that really big feature of where I live and work in the northeast of England, you know, one of the first industrial places in the world and one of the first post-industrial places in the world. And, you know, not then coincidentally a place that doesn't have very good health outcomes, some of the highest levels of health inequalities in terms of the poorest health are here where we're talking, where I live and work, and that again is a product for me of the particular form of capitalism that we've had in the UK, and quite a political attack on sort of places that were formerly left-wing Labour heartlands, getting in the way of the kind of societal transformation that the Conservative Thatcher government was trying to enact. So, I mean, I guess the point there is we would probably we would have become a post-industrial place, but the way we've managed that has been extremely detrimental to people's health and overall quality of life and economic sort of standards, etc., in these particular places. So it sort of does tie together. The climate change adaptation was not, less of an initial interest of mine, and that was quite interesting because it wasn't such a, we found that wasn't such a priority for local systems to adapt these kinds of resilience plans, but certain service providers with a specific emergency plan, etc., they had a specific responsibility for this. So it became quite interesting because it told us quite a lot about the demands on the governance system, and actually in lots of places, again, this happened in a particular period of our history around austerity and massive reduction in public sector funding. We're trying to push out this agenda across the governance system, but people are saying, well, essentially we have other priorities. There's too many demands on our time. We've quite constrained in what we can do. And climate change adaptation and in a place like the UK, which, to be fair, we have extreme weather events, but they're not massively extreme. But anyway, that became really interesting because it sort of revealed to me about local governance as well, which is what I was interested in. But they were all good and really sort of lucky as well in terms of they're quite good experiences, or experienced again through working on those projects. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Thank you. I mean, it's really interesting to hear about the connections, I think, between those points, and part of what's useful for the kinds of conversations that we have, particularly the topic that goes along with this podcast, but regularly on the podcast as I talk to other people, is that the complexity of these problems and the ways that they're interlinked are really important for us thinking about social policy. So we're thinking about health outcomes, thinking about how climate change might impact on healthcare outcomes is really important.
Yeah.
Or, thinking about class and the history of a place and the industrialization and post-industrial kind of spaces help us think again about what are the impacts on people's health, the impacts on the climate, and how do we see them as connected issues and therefore analyze them that way as well and act on them, hopefully, for the practitioners as well, to understand a person and their context in a holistic way. So that's awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
Let's transition a little bit to talking about your book. Before I ask you to tell us some more about it, there are a couple of key frameworks in there that you're using and borrowing from, and I'm going to ask you to tell us kind of the short version of them. And I know that's a real challenge. There's this interesting competition that we have in Australia for PhD students called Three-Man Thesis. I have to try and jam really, really big, complex ideas into a short space, that I know that's what we're trying to ask you to do here. But the kind of two things I'd love you to explain for us are complexity theory and sort of what the social contract is.
There's the one, I do complexity first. That is, I think that's the harder one to explain.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, to be fair, I've had students say this. It is, it can be sort of smoke and mirrors rhetoric complexity. But I mean, I don't agree with that. But there is a language around complexity which I think is useful, but also can turn people off as well in terms of the way the language is used. But so complexity theory for me is interesting because for me, I got into it as a health researcher, But in health research, positivism, the medical model, is very dominant.
Of course.
And my sort of academic mentors and bosses were not in that field, and quite antagonistic to this idea of you know, isolating and creating barriers about things. So for me, complexity is about trying to make, as you were saying, you know, draw those linkages between phenomena and how they're influencing each other. But then that's then very difficult to measure and understand. There's different approaches to doing that. But then there is a strand within complexity which says, well, it can also be used as a heuristic kind of device. We can use it because it makes sense to explain certain things. So some key terms in complexity theory is that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts in terms of the interactions that are ongoing. But there's other language there, like around the idea of things like co-evolution, that things evolve and develop together and they're interacting together over time. It's not exclusively in complexity theory, but path dependency again is a big theme and idea, that the idea that there is a particular trajectory of a system. And systems will interact with each other at different layers and in different ways. And it's sort of saying, basically, there's lots of these things going on. And then a particular method I used early on was qualitative comparative analysis, which is about sort of configurational thinking. And what that method does then, so this was on the Health Inequalities Project, and it would say there could be a combination of factors around progress or a lack of progress towards these health inequality targets, these health inequality gaps. And it doesn't try and do this then in an additive way. It says actually the researcher can try and unpick that, and maybe in a way, and what we did was try to do that through sort of co-production with people in terms of interrogating the results and interrogating then some profiles of places. But you have things that are interacting together, but you're not necessarily saying you need to put an exact measure on them, but the combination is important. They're different, and context then can be factored in, but then certain approaches to say things like around cancer mortality, maybe, you know, smoking cessation services working really well. We had this, actually we had this really counterintuitive finding, which was around areas were saying that they were doing lots of essentially planning work to an extremely high standard. And this was in the New Labour years, where we had lots of performance management, lots of audit assessment. And we had a group of cases which were doing those things well, and didn't have what was being described as a championing culture around cancers. They didn't have an individual that was taking lead responsibility. And there were some other things going on in these configurations. But these areas were doing worse, despite saying that they were doing better on planning. And what we said was, potentially, actually, this then is an overly bureaucratic approach. You're spending too much time on plans, on looking good on paper, and at the same time, you don't have this sort of lead responsibility that is saying, we need to target these. And then, you know, then that links in with literature around cancers and the importance of early screening. And, you know, so we developed and worked on a narrative around those results. But so that's, you know, just an example of that. But that's probably more than 3 minutes.
That's okay. But that's, I think, really useful. And I think for the conversations that we have, again, this podcast, this topic, it's really useful to be reminded of, firstly, kind of how complex those social problems are. We often talk about social problems as wicked problems. And
very strong history in Australia.
I give the example, which I think is kind of similar to the example you're giving with health and smoking. There was quite a successful social policy, particularly in South Australia, around drink driving, so drinking alcohol and then driving afterwards. And it was quite successful in terms of driving down the number of people who would be drink driving. But one of the unexpected and counterintuitive outcomes was that there was an increase in kind of alcohol-related violence in key areas of the city. And what they found was that people would just drink beforehand, or go into the city and have a designated driver, but then that allowed somebody to drink more because somebody else was driving home. So that complexity, but also the potential to make a problem worse in some ways through social policies. Important part of it. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
The second question was about
So I think that the reason I like social contract again. I did a module, a small module in my undergraduate studies on Rousseau in undergraduate politics. I think it was a whole module on him. Anyway, but I always liked his work, and I always liked the idea of a social contract, that there is a deal between members of society and the state. But in that deal, there is a question of, well, is it mutually beneficial? Is it worthwhile? We don't actually, have to participate in society if we don't want to in certain ways, if the conditions are not sufficiently good. That is problematic in terms of the legitimacy of all the institutions, and in terms of stability ultimately. And that key to a lot of social contract theorists will be, well, on what basis do we have an agreement that we are going to have a degree of stability, a set of rules that allows us to function? And what I like about Rousseau, though, is he says that so then one thing then is, and I say in the book, is then that is sort of analytical. It puts a lens on society. We can ask those questions: what is the deal on which we're participating in society, and how does that vary across different groups, different places, geographical places, different gender, ethnicity, you can look at it in lots of different ways. What Rousseau then says, though, is his argument is for more equality. We need an egalitarian society with quite strong level, high levels of equality, in order to pursue our individual freedom. And he's very much making the point from the stance of freedom to, as opposed to freedom from intervention in individual lives. But he also then argues for a very strong form of intervention, which is essentially redistribution to level the playing field. But his idea, and one that I like, is then that strengthens social ties and actually allows us to be more true to ourselves as individuals, because we are not in this sort of competitive position of more difference, more conflict. Yeah, it creates a really solid platform for people to express individuality, which I think, I really like that point, and chimes with my politics. But I also think it is true. Often, sometimes arguments for more equality are viewed as being anti-freedom, against anti-individualism, but actually I think they can create the basis for more individualism, more relaxed individualism. But yeah, so that's why I quite like the idea of the social contract, and I think so I use it as an analytical but prescriptive device. The other thing I do, though, is say that this is obviously, in contemporary capitalist societies, things have changed quite a lot, and we have some very ingrained forms of capitalism in terms of consumption, consumer practices. People have benefited a lot from capitalism and like the lifestyle there, and the system has become increasingly linked to that and rigged by that, I think, too, in terms of the way that the relationship between sort of economic interests and politics combined. So we're no longer in this position, I don't think, of Rousseau's view of human nature being essentially good. I think we have, I'm not saying human nature is bad, but yeah, he comes from a point of view that we are inherently good, but I think that things have moved on, and we are so ingrained in a system of capitalism that we've become wed to some of those behaviours. So I'm not as optimistic as he is about human nature.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. And I think part of what I'm taking away from that is you're highlighting the assumptions that we come to this space with. Is it freedom to or freedom from? Is that what's our understanding of the role of the state to manage or intervene or not into our lives, and then what are the assumptions that come with capitalism? Often this is something that we kind of take for granted. Mm. It's a background voice, but maybe we need to spend more time actually looking at what those assumptions it brings. Mm. But then you were talking about inequality, and that's a kind of major part of your book, is a question you pose is how much inequality can we tolerate, should we tolerate in our society, and to what extent is it legitimate for the state to really intervene? Can you tell us a bit more about what your position is in the book on that?
Yeah, so I think we intervene in the wrong ways. I think we are quite interventionist in people's lives. Often some of the less well-off, less affluent people in society who have quite a negative experience of being monitored and surveilled by the state and then being told. And then we say to the same people, oh, by the way, here's this health advice, you need to follow these behaviors and you will live a longer life, and so that you have this very unequal society where people are sort of have a negative relationship with the state. But then the key part of social policy is saying, but do what we say, it's for your best, and you will do better. So the classic example of smoking again is like, well, public health messaging around smoking generally, historically, has always worked more with affluent people in terms of quitting. And you get people saying, well, we just need to educate people more. But my view is, no, we don't. It's not a hard message. A lot of people don't have a problem understanding smoking is harmful.
Yeah.
You have a problem in terms of having, differential motivation to quit. And that is a problem of inequality and unequal experience. In terms of then, like this, so I think, the UK, having, especially post the 1980s, since Thatcher onwards, has been very much a freedom, quite strongly influenced by freedom too, and a lack of sort of intervention in things. But then there is this paradox there where it is quite, as I say, quite a monitoring and surveillance kind of state too.
Mm.
But what we've done is we've said freedom, the economy needs freedom to not be regulated, to be deregulated, and freedom, for them entrepreneurs to create entrepreneurial economic growth, wealth, things like that, which, I can obviously understand that argument. But this has produced very high levels of inequality. So to use a complexity term, in the 1980s, we went through what would be described doing the book, described this as other people do too, but as a phase shift in inequalities in society. We moved, this was a massive increase in income inequalities, which massively underestimate wealth inequalities, which are much more severe but more hidden. But there was a big jump over a 10-year period. And this then, in complexity terms, let's say you're moving to a new possibility space. It's a new attractor in mathematical language, which is not that important. but this then is a change in type as opposed to a change in degree. We became a new, different type of society with much higher levels of inequality, and that was from this argument about being free from intervention, and then freeing people up to fulfill their potential, not creating dependency on the state, and so you have, change in the whole sort of tax system, the labour market, lots of things, but also social policy then became, less generous too, because of this argument around a dependency. Again, state intervention is preventing us from being, as we should be, and for me that's where we should be intervening much more. That would be, better from the point of view then of social policy, to be able to, level the playing field more. And then these kinds of policy interventions, policy programs are taking place on a more equal footing, and have, instead of having a headwind, a very strong headwind. You know, they have a you know, at least a solid footing, maybe not a tailwind, but you know, I think we have to deal with some of those inequalities. But the, I guess the point that I'm making is what I'm arguing for is absolutely not viewed as legitimate within the social contract as I see it. Our society does not want that kind of redistribution, does not want to take those kinds of measures. And I think that, you know, with the social contract as a lens on society, I think, you know, it at least sort of points out that certain things which might be helpful are not popular or not don't have a degree of legitimacy. But again, sort of going back to this idea that the system isn't perfect, it's rigged. There's, you know, Colin Crouch's work on post-democracy, I quite like that in that sense, in terms of saying that it's occurring within that kind of space. It's not, you know, it's not like that society is ideally, you know, democracy doesn't function in a perfect way.
That makes sense. Okay, so let me see if I can kind of capture a little bit, obviously, because you touched on some really important bases, but I really like the idea that you're saying we need to shift where we're focusing the policy intervention from running around kind of addressing all these kind of little health issues or other kind of you know, isolated, individualized issues, and instead focusing more on the fundamental inequality. And if we can address the fundamental inequality, we're likely to see much better or a different kind of progress in those spaces. But then you said you know, that's not desirable within the current social contract. So is the social contract that we have broken, or is it just different to what it, you know, once was, you know, in this kind of space of competitive individualism where it has that strong social appeal? What do we do with that if we can't, where do we have opportunities, I suppose, for action to create better opportunity?
So I don't 100%, I don't know. So it's different.
It's kind of the big, hard, impossible big question, isn't it? Yeah, so no pressure.
I think, I mean, one thing I argue is we need to take ownership of these things more, as they're not like a like, you know, if we think these are bad outcomes, if we think that there's, you know, really big gaps in life expectancy and healthy life expectancy, and this maps on to every income decile, there's a complete, you know, very strong social gradient that shows, you know, socioeconomic status, you link it to place as well. It's not random, it is systematic and systemic. If we think that's a big problem, which we say we do, then I do think then we have to start saying, well, what policy levers, what policy tools do we have? And there is sort of a growing move to say, you know, tax is a part of, you know, a policy lever and around redistribution. And so you have this example, so with health inequalities, like lots of inequalities targets, the UK was and may again, the government's been very vague on this, but has a narrowing gap target. But the idea then is the bottom has to narrow the gap at the top. And what I always sort of say is the top is not stopping, the top, it's a moving target. And they're doing that from a much more privileged position. Now, policy then is trying to help, particularly areas on the bottom, to not only keep pace, but outsprint the top. And you have to go faster and better than the very healthiest, wealthiest places in order to narrow these gaps. And then that becomes, you know, an incredibly challenging thing to do. And that's where then redistribution for me becomes, you know, I think, you know, pretty fundamental. It's like to say we need to somewhat slow the progress of those that are at the top end of the inequality in order for those at the bottom to then have additional resource and redistribute that resource to the bottom. So it's partly slowing progress and then partly using that resource to inject further wealth, money, you know, in the local economies and societies, create better jobs, which, you know, but better context, better community, you know, but not better communities, because that's, but, you know, better resourced communities, mm-hmm. In order to sort of enable them to go quicker. And in, I get in the book, I call that, then there's different ways. So complexity theory and policy can often be about calibrating the gearing of the system, I say, or improving the gearing, oiling it, making it function better. And that's really important, and policy does that a lot. But my sort of question is, well, do we actually need to create a new gearing of the system in order to, you know, fundamentally change a bit the type, the kind? You know, again, that's a, it's not just a question of degree, it's a question of type. It's a qualitatively different thing as opposed to, you know, just incrementally. And yeah, that's what I would like to see more. But then we do, as you say, then competitive and possessive individualism. We like to consume. We like to own what we consume. And yeah, I was thinking before in the UK, we also, yeah, we're quite a conservative country in lots of ways. I mean, to me, it's baffling. I think it's okay because, but we, you know, we have a new king, we have a queen who died, we have a lot of respect around these institutions, which I can't understand. But, you know, within them, there is a societal belief that certain people in certain positions are naturally allocated to those positions because of their worth, their merit, and their status. And we don't, in the UK, we don't want to rock that fundamentally. We believe in hierarchy of status, and we also then like to, you know, compete, but from an unequal playing field. We like competition too, as obviously as does Australia. Very really good at competition, competition is also fun.
Yeah,
it's fun. But in the book I say, but it's actually more fun if it's an equal competition, tight match or something, rather than a. But there is something in human nature that I think likes these things. And then within the UK, you know, there's obviously particular dynamics too within different countries.
That's correct. Thank you. I mean, one of the things I really like about the way you're describing these mechanisms and also, you know, what you describe in your book is the you're pointing out the ironies of the system. You know, you're saying you want to close a gap, but you know, if you have a system which is built on continual growth, then the mob can only ever get further away. Or you know, look at these institutions that we have in a society that are fundamentally representing inequality that we continue to celebrate. So how do we challenge those? That's tricky. Thank you so much. This is a really interesting conversation. I think I would like to talk about it more. I'm sure other people would as well. So can you give us a shameless self-plug? Where can we find I'll provide a link to the book and as the stuff.
Well, probably that. Yeah, I think probably my email address is best. I'm not on social media. I'm on some of the ResearchGate and LinkedIn, but I don't really use them. I accept request. I just look at somebody. The short answer is email. But I'd be very happy to respond to emails. And you know, I've got my staff profile on the university. But yeah, I don't really use any social media, which is good for me, I think, but not necessarily good for my career. But it's not my thing.
It would be better for a lot of our mental health if we were less on social media.
Exactly. That's fine. I've completely,
cut that off.
That's
fine. I'll put a couple of links there. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyed the conversation.
Great. Me too. Yeah.
This episode was edited by Ryan Manheyer, music by Anthem of Rain, sourced from the freemusicarchive.org. You can find me, Ben, on Twitter @LohmeyerBen. If you like the podcast, please like, share, comment, and do all the things.